can treat that as more of notation than as code. So it really don't need to know programming to understand that, but it's just to give a flavor of what's the kind of techniques that are being adopted, or explain the technique in a better manner. I thought examples would be a useful thing. So, but if any notation is just unclear, just ask. So the general outline is going to be, I'm going to introduce the various technologies and techniques that are followed today, both in the, I would say in the borderline of research and practice. Those are technologies that are waiting to be just adopted in the in practice, but it's not yet fully adopted, but there are people who have started using it. So that's a, those are the kind of technologies I will be seeing. So current state of those technologies in terms of industry code, where they stand, how much are they able to do, with some examples of experiments that we have conducted and others have conducted. Based on that, I'll present that and do a reality check. So where, what does the world want, where are we today, that kind of one slide on just that. So that's the general outline for the talk today. Is software verification critical? Is it such an important topic? It is very, very important in some way or the other. I've just picked a few of recent failures due to software. A more general trend is that vehicle recalls are increasing decade on decade. In every decade, the number of vehicles that are being recalled is just going up. It's not going down. And the reason being software is now more prominent. There was a time when there was a number which said around 60% of vehicle recalls are due to a software problem. There have been recent Nissan airbag problems, Volvo airbag problems, apart from Volvo's purported malicious intent, but there have been various other mishaps which have been due to. And it cuts across industries. So there is, I'm more familiar with the auto industry because I'm the teams that we work with are more in the automotive domain, but this cuts across. Knight Capital bought and sold shares at a loss of total loss of 440 million. So there was this software bug because of which it was selling at a loss. It was selling, buying, selling, buying, selling, buying at a loss. And before they realized it had resulted in a loss of 440 million. So it can be expensive. And with the amount of software that we are getting into, it's one of the top three causes of medical device recalls. So pick a domain, pick an industry, software is there and software is causing problems. That's the reality, and therefore there is clearly a need for techniques that will reduce the number of recalls, or at least minimize the number of recalls. I don't think it's possible to eliminate it altogether, but at least how do we really recall? The future is even more complex. This is already in the present where there is a lot of, in the future you're going to have more and more automation, more and more autonomous. Yeah. So you're right. So I'm going to highlight, hopefully I would have highlighted today that it's just not possible to thoroughly test it with the current state of verification technology. That's the reason verification technology becomes very critical. And hopefully by end of today we'll realize that it's not just poor testing that's causing recalls. It's the scale of the magnitude of the problem is such that the recalls are imminent. Or there was this, so more and more rescue operation, everything is becoming robotic and that makes things even worse. For instance, there have been two Tesla crashes. It's because it didn't recognize some objects. How do you test for it? How do you define what's an object? The problems start from there. So things are getting only worse from a complexity perspective. And therefore, it's not surprising that recalls are increasing. It's just because the complexity of what these companies are doing is growing at a much faster pace than those who are working in the verification field are able to help them. That's the reality. So some terminologies used in the largely in the verification community. One is, how do you say a piece of software is correct? The most mathematical view is just prove it correct and you're done. prove that it is doing what it is intended to do, and then there can be no problems. There can be absolutely no problems. So that's the proving. The second one is testing, which is you just try it out on a few sample. If it works fine, you say yes. As far as I'm concerned, it's working fine because I've tried it a bit and it doesn't seem to have any problem. Third is verification, which is that you're given a piece of software and you're told that it must satisfy certain properties. And then at least with respect to those properties, you prove that it is correct. So you don't really prove it for all requirements. You tend to do it only for a bunch of properties. So a lot of my talk today will be on the verification aspect. I have one slide on proving and testing. I'll not delve deeper into those. I'll be spending more time on verification, more because I'm more familiar with that area. And that's also an area which needs your organization. So proving. What is proving? So you've got requirements, which is there somewhere. Someone knows what the requirements are. And you try to get two specifications out of it. One is the implementation, which is there anyway, because that's the software that's going to run. And you try and get an alternative specification, which is the formal methods community calls that a formal specification. But you try and get an alternative specification so that you can compare, are these two specifications equivalent? And you rely on the fact that nobody will make the same mistake in both. So you just prove that one is equivalent to the other and you say, yes, software is doing well. That's proving. The problem, it's proved to be impractical. This is what the formal methods community initially wanted to do, achieve, which is try and be able to prove a lot of software. They developed a lot of techniques towards that. One is automatic derivation, automatic proving, theorem provers, everything, but it didn't really take up in practice because of several problems. One is, of course, in the general case, it is undecidable. Essentially, what that means is you cannot build an automated prover that can prove. Even if you're given a formal specification and an implementation, it's theoretically not always possible to prove that they are equivalent. So that's one hurdle. The second biggest hurdle is for any reasonably complex system, nobody knows the requirements. Nobody knows the requirements. So we have had interactions with Bang & Olufsen. They make these home systems, and we have worked with them to try and get some sense of formal specifications. And we say, but what happens when the user performs the following sequence of action? Bang & Olufsen response is, we don't care what happens. Yeah? So long as it doesn't crash, because we don't expect the users to follow these kind of actions. And if the user does do those, it really doesn't matter to us. There are these bunch of actions on which it should behave well. But the rest, we really don't care. So nobody knows what the requirements are. And most often, they don't care what the requirements are beyond a certain level of detail. They just don't care what the requirements are. And it can behave any which way it needs to. So that's another big hurdle to be able to prove a requirement. So for example, if you take a mobile phone, where should it display, when all should it be, what sequence of click should result in what? Beyond a point, nobody cares. And that's why it's very hard to get a formal specification for that. So that's another big hurdle to proving. And creating formal specifications can be really expensive because you're virtually doing the implementation twice. It's at least twice as expensive as getting the first implementation in place. So that's the third big hurdle to using proving as a technique to be able to address the problem of. So that's a reason why this is just not taken off. And then there are many other practical reasons. There are no provers which are automated because of the undecidability. They're all interactive, and engineers do not want to indulge in an interactive proving. But I believe the more important reasons are these. There are no requirements and there are no. The second is testing. Testing is essentially, you're given this piece of software you are trying it out, you give it to some expert testers, and they take it and then they try doing various things with it and then see what's the result. So Google Car, which is roaming around in California and various parts of US, it's essentially getting tested on whatever they are trying to do with it. So the disadvantage of testing is it guarantees almost nothing. It absolutely gives no guarantees. It just says that there is this bunch of things which for which it will run when we ran it in the circumstances under which it was, we ran it. You run the same sequence elsewhere, whether it will work, it doesn't give you any guarantees. Yeah. So testing virtually gives no guarantees, but it's the most practical. Yeah. It's the technique that is used widely. It's the only technique virtually used widely. They just rely on the fact that you give it to enough testers, just let them test it sufficiently, and hopefully all our typical users will have fall into the same category, and therefore the probability of them finding a problem is low. That's what it really relies on. But software has a serious issue that if one user hits a problem spot, then that just spreads very quickly, because then that software is going to have that problem spot every time you do it that way. Okay? So that's one problem. And that as a result, there are these recalls. If one user finds a problem, the company just has to recall, just can't do anything. Validating runs is very expensive. So a tester may run it on a whole lot of data, but even a tester doesn't know is it running correctly. Unless there is a serious crash or a serious problem, even the tester is likely to miss something that's gone wrong. So validating whether a test has run correctly is very, very expensive. Yeah. And there are certain categories of bugs which are hard or nearly impossible to find using testing. Essentially, things that need very smart directed checks are very hard to find using testing. So that's a big disadvantage of testing, but it's the only way that's largely used today for checking for, whether a piece of software is running correctly or not, or anything. Actually, whatever applies to software applies to most products. It's just software happens to be one of the more complex products, but otherwise it just applies to most things. Then finally, we have verification, which is essentially you're given a piece of software and you're given a bunch of properties. And you show automatically that as far as this bunch of properties go, the software will definitely behave correctly. So that's the verification challenge. So for example, you say, show that this piece of software does not have a security hole. That's just to abstract a property. You would say this software does not have a security hole because of a buffer overrun. That's a level of at which you can show properties, and one just hopes that over a period of time, one knows a whole lot of problems. Since the software should never hang or should not never deadlock, but there are some such standard properties that you give, and you say, now I want to show that this piece of software confirms to this bunch of properties. The properties here will not be anywhere close to the complete requirements. It's just a small part of the requirements, but hopefully it covers all the safety parts of the requirements. So long as it satisfies the property, even if the software doesn't behave correctly, it's not going to do any serious harm. That's the hope, that you have enough properties which save you from these, and therefore it's therefore you hope that will just solve your problem. Yeah. So verification is an area where a lot of effort has been spent. There has been a lot of modern advances in tools and techniques in the area of verification, and that's what I'll spend the rest of my talk on where we are with respect to verification and where we are with respect to. So the key challenges in verification are scalability and precision. Yeah. So that's what I will really look at, what these two are. So just to give a idea of what kind of properties there could be and what kind of verification challenges could there be there. Yeah, here's first I have some code snippets. So some of the here's an example. So let's assume I have tried to make it as notational as possible. Non-negative variables I and j. So I and j are two names. They are assigned some arbitrary values. No, both non-negative though. Yeah, they are assigned non-negative values. And then you have a thing. If j is less than I, you get j dash is equal to I. You assign the value of I to j dash. Otherwise, you increment. Assign the value j plus 1 to j dash. Yeah, so that's what you're doing. And you want to check, is there a division by 0 here? Whether j dash will ever get the value 0. Okay. So that's the kind of problems you really want to solve using verification. In this case, you won't, because j and I are non-negative. And you're going here only when j is less than I. Therefore, I will be greater than 0. And therefore, j dash will get a non-zero value. And here you're incrementing j. The lowest value for j is 0. Therefore, when you increment it, it will be non-zero. And therefore, it will not be 0. Yeah. So in this particular example, it will be non-zero. But that gives an kind of examples for which we really do a verification. Here is another example. These are very domain-specific properties. In a vehicle, you want to say whenever a brake is pressed, you need to stop within so much time. In a accounting system, you want to say corresponding to every debit entry, I want a credit entry so that there is a balance, assuming it's a double-sided accounting system. And the night mutual fund guys financial guys would have wanted to say never sell at a loss. Yeah. That's a simple property that could have been checked for their system. Never sell at a loss. Nobody will ever want to sell within a millisecond at a loss and continue repeating that transaction. So that's a very easy to state domain property. So that's something they would have liked to have. And here's another thing, I won't get into the details of it. This essentially says you've got a transfer account, you're transferring from one account to the other by calling a credit and a debit simultaneously. Yeah. You fire two transactions, a credit and a debit, and let them go on parallelly. And that can lead to problems, because you may end up the balance, if you do a transfer from the same account to the same account, you may end up with an incorrect balance. So that's the kind of thing that is there. So verification, the key challenges in verification is that there are three properties that verifiers have. Soundness, which essentially says that every bug, every property violation would be reported. Every potential property violation would be reported. That's soundness. Precision, which says that everything that is reported would be a bug. Yeah? So soundness is every potential bug would be reported. Precision is every reported item would be a bug. The ratio, how many items are reported versus how many of them are bugs, that's the precision measure. And scalability, how large a problem can it solve? And these are orthogonal properties. So it's very hard to address all three. If you compromise on soundness, you can improve on scalability and precision. If you compromise on precision, you can improve on scalability and soundness. And if you can, so it's a choice that a tool developer today has to make. And how well they perform on all three axes is a measure of how good that tool is. How far they go on all three axes is the measure of how good a tool is. So based on this, there are broadly three technologies that are used. One is what's known as program analysis or static analysis. That is very sound because it uses techniques that are sound. So everything that it reports, every bug that is potentially there would be reported by that tool. It's very scalable because it uses very lightweight techniques and therefore it can scale to millions of lines of code, but it's imprecise. So what that means is it will report a lot of false alarms. So many of what it reports could be false, may not be genuinely bugs. So some user or programmer engineer has to go through it and wade through all that to decide whether it's a bug or not. Second is model checkers. Very precise. If they report something as a bug, it will be a bug. And it's also sound. So if it's a potential bug, it will definitely report it. But it doesn't scale. And then there are a lot of tools which use heuristics-based analysis, which says whenever the programmer codes this way, it's likely to be there is a potential problem, or whenever the programmer programs this way, it's unlikely to be a problem. They have already taken care of potential problem. There are a lot of heuristic-based analysis tools. They are very fast, they scale up well, but they are unsound. And the heuristics are such that they are precise. So you design your heuristics to be precise. But they are unsung. In the sense, they may miss a whole heap of bugs. So these are the three kinds of technologies that are out there and that can be used. Soundness, I mean that if you're checking for a property, if you're going to try and find it, it's a recall and precision in case you want to do, not completeness. There's no completeness. So that's completeness. I'm tracking it as scalability. So it may say, I don't know. I'm unable to solve this problem. Completeness is I'm putting it under scalability. It might just go on forever and not come back with an answer. That I'm saying is a scalability. I'm just bucketing it under scalability. Because we don't know why it can't do it, whether it's a completeness issue or a. It could be a wrong answer. It says there is no bug here, but there could actually be a bug. That's unsound.
Why is it called a static? What is static about static?
So I will be covering that. What's static about static analysis? So I will be covering static analysis to some extent and SAT, SMT, or model checking to some extent, and not doing heuristic based thing. Static analysis has been around for a very, very long time. Since programming languages were invented, there have been static analysis tools. They are very abstract. The reason they are called static analysis, they analyze the code without actually executing it. So they don't really run it for all input values. That's the reason they are called static analysis tool, as opposed to runtime analysis. So the categorization is there's static analysis and there's dynamic analysis. Dynamic analysis is testing kind of tools which actually execute the program to find out whether there is a problem or not. And static analysis are programs that do not execute the program to figure out whether there is a problem or not. Yeah. To derive various properties of the program. In here, we are looking at whether there is a bug or not. So that's the reason they are called static analysis. Yeah. And static analysis started performing really well once we had abstract interpretation was invented. And abstract interpretation based techniques were started being adopted. So static analysis, like any analysis techniques, are used for very standard problems. They are not used for any domain-specific problems. They are instead used for very programming language-specific or an operating system-specific. Detect operating system or programming, like a division by zero, or if there's an array in there, are you accessing? a bounded array, are you trying to access it beyond the bounds that have been given for that array? That's the kind of array. So what it does is creates an abstract mathematical representation of the program, an abstract model that it can analyze. The actual code is too complex to be analyzed. So it creates an abstraction and it tries to analyze that abstract program, and that it can analyze. But because it's an abstraction, it can potentially report errors which are not actually errors, because it's working at an abstract level. That's what is makes it imprecise. So let's take the same example. So you have a non-negative, again it's the non-negative variables I and j. You've got j, if j less than I, make j equal to I, else j equal to j plus 1, and you want to check whether j is 0 at that point, right? So abstract interpretation thing would say, okay, because there is a divide by 0 check, I'm only going to track whether a variable can be 0 or not. I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to look at the actual values of the variable. Just going to track whether a variable can be 0 or not. So at this point, both j and I can be 0. Yeah. So that's what it tracks. Now, when it comes here, it says j can be 0. It doesn't need to, but that's one possible. It depends on how much of math is encoded into the abstract interpretation. But one possibility is that at this point, it can say, it says j can be 0, because j and I can be 0 here. I is being assigned to j, therefore j can be 0 here. Slightly more precise analysis tool would say j and I can be 0 here. At this point, j can be 0, but I cannot be 0, because you have done a j less than I, and therefore it will be able to figure out. Yeah. So the main point I want to make here is a static analysis tools works at an abstract level. So here it only tracks whether j and I can be 0 or not, and does that without executing the program. And as a result, it will make a lot of approximate assumptions, conservative assumptions at various points. And therefore, it can result in potential warnings, basically warnings that need not necessarily be bugs. Yeah. So there are various kinds of abstract interpretation. There is a whole heap of research on abstract interpretation which tracks Boolean values or tracks ranges of values that a variable can take, can tracks difference between variables, given any pair of variables, tracks differences between them, polyhedral and octagonal. There are all kinds of abstract domains which abstract interpretations do. And each, the more sophisticated the domain, the more precise they get, but as they get more precise, they lose on scalability. So that's, dichotomy is always there. So the question is static analysis useful? So we had conducted some experiments where we took actual bugs that have been reported post delivery. Yeah. That were reported post delivery, and we analyzed them to see how many of those bugs could have been detected statically without having to really run the program, without having to test the program, and how many of them are free of domain. In the sense, you don't need domain knowledge; they are just problems that are because of the platform, wrong usage of platform or wrong understanding of the programmer errors. Yeah. And we found that more than 30% of defects, and this we are talking of defects that are all post-production defects, more than 30% of defects could have been detected if they had used a static analysis tool for an appropriate kind of errors. Like whether errors are being trapped everywhere. There are some whole heap of possible things that you can analyze using static analysis if they had used static analysis. And then we did some very conservative analysis for a office automation company, and we didn't do it. They arrived at a figure of $1 million. Basically, they just took the cost of fixing those bugs after they were reported. And it's an office automation, so there's no recall. So it's very cheap. If some other companies, when there are, where recalls are involved, it becomes much more expensive. Right? No. So that depends on the actual tool they run. So we just analyze the defects. The actual defects that were reported from the field, we had access to the database. we just manually analyze those to see how many of them could have been detected. Yeah, similarly, we did for a vehicle infotainment system, and even there we had similar numbers. So, static analysis is most definitely useful, or verification of any kind is most definitely pure financially, it makes a lot of sense if we can get good solutions in this.
So, why is that done?
So, that's hopefully will you will, because it throws a lot of false alarms. And engineers do not want to wade through all that false alarms to determine which of those are genuine and which of those are not. That's the reason it's not gone through routinely. No. We just collected defects from the field, analyzed them manually, and said this can be done through static analysis, this cannot be done using static analysis. Just categorize them into two buckets. Could have been solved using a static analysis, couldn't have been found using a static analysis too. That's all we did. True. You can just instantiate it. What?
I don't think it's very costly.
It is very costly. It's not. That's what SIGAR is all about. And it's very costly. Yes. Static analysis of the code.
It's just verification of how your
syntax are. No. It's actually, so here it was really looking at divide by zero. It's not syntax. So here, so this is to give you some idea of numbers. Yeah. Here we have analyzed it for, this is a 2 million lines of code. It has got some large arrays and all, and the tool reports 77 zero division by zero warnings. 77, which is not at all a big number considering that the number of lines of code is 2 million, but when it's 2 million lines of code for an engineer to analyze whether it's really a bug is a problem. Yeah. And here's a smart card component where again loops with large bounds and unknown bounds. There were 55 warnings, all zero division warnings. Yeah. This is just to give you a flavor of what's the kind of warnings that are there. And many of them would be false. Most of them, I would say 90%+ of them would be false. There'll be very few of them because these are all fairly well tested code. We are not trying at the this thing. And here is 6,000 lines of code, 128 array index out of bound, and 43 zero division warnings that we are getting. For a, yeah. So that's the, it should give you, just to give an idea of what's the number of problems that a static analysis tool reports. Now, why isn't a static analysis tool able to solve it? Here are two examples picked up from these applications. These are two loops that we have been picked up from these applications. One is a very straightforward thing. J is getting assigned a random even number. Yeah. And here it's getting incremented by 2. And you're accessing array with J plus 1. So all you want to know is whether J plus 1 will ever be 512. Yeah. You enter this only when it's less than 512. Yeah, you enter this only when J is less than 512. So you can theoretically enter it when it's 511, in which case this becomes 512, which is incorrect. It shouldn't. But you can, J will never be 511 because you're initializing it to an even number and you're always incrementing it by 2. So it will never be 511. So you will only enter, last time you will enter it is when it is 510. So it will never be 500. But this is very hard for static analysis tools to figure out, because it needs to know number theory, modulo arithmetic, and all that. Here is something that is even harder, again picked up from an actual code. What this person is trying to do is T is number of seconds. Yeah. There is a piece of code that here, which and just wants to determine the date and time or something like that. I'm guessing. Yeah. For every month, the number of seconds in that month is stored in this array. Right? For every month. For Jan, how many seconds? Feb, how many seconds? March, how many seconds is stored in that array? Decrementing the time by that for that month. And till while it is greater than the number of seconds in the next month. So, it will figure out in which month that time falls. Yeah? That's what is being done here. And you want to know that it will never overshoot 12. Because there are only 12 months, you should never overshoot 12. That's what you want to check. And this cannot be done unless you add up that entire array. And check, ensure that that is definitely greater than So these are the kind of code, that pieces of code that are there that make it very hard for static analysis tools to work. No, no, no. At this point, a program doesn't know what's the contents of the seconds array. So it, unless it knows the contents and then adds them up, it has to know A, it has to know that it's got the contents of the seconds array. Second, it has to know that what is getting subtracted here is the maximum that can be subtracted is the total sum of the contents of the seconds of each month. And therefore, it will never be less. So, it's a lot of math is needed to be able to figure it out. It cannot be figured out without that. And there's a summation needed, there is all that needed. So, leap years is, we assume, is not a problem. Whether it has a bug because of leap years, I don't know. It's quite likely to have, but I don't know. So there's a lot of, the problem with raw static analysis is that it's got a lot of false warnings. Satisfiability checking. So satisfiability checking is, you're given a predicate formula, rain implies wet and rain and not wet. You're given a predicate formula, like propositional formula like this, and you want to check, is there a satisfiability assignment to it? That is all you want to do. Yeah. So all that you need is, you're given a propositional formula of Boolean variables combined using AND, OR, NOT, and then you want to check, is there an assignment to those variables which will satisfy the formula, for which the formula will result true. It is known to be an NP complete problem, which essentially means it is known that there does not exist an polynomial time algorithm to find that assignment. So that's, but SAT solvers have been engineered really well to make them practical these days. So that's the reason satisfiability is gaining a lot of attention of late. And programs can be converted into a satisfiability formula. This can be done. But for that, the programs have to be finite programs. So you cannot have unknown loops, loops with unknown bounds. You cannot have anything which is for which you don't know the bound. It has to be a finite program, and only finite programs can be converted to transformed into a satisfiability formula. And then you can check whether x is equal to 0. For a division by 0 error, you just check whether x is equal to, add an additional term, x is equal to 0, and check whether that is satisfiable or not. If it is satisfiable, then you have a division by zero error. If it is not, you don't have a division by zero. Advantage is, it's very precise. And not only is it precise, if it finds a bug, it also gives you a trace. What's the input which will cause that failure to occur? Yeah. SAT solvers performances have improved a lot over years, and that's the reason why we are looking at SAT solvers. And it's got a wide range of applications, planning, optimizations, combinatorial problems. It can be applied in a whole heap of domains. That's the, because many of these can be translated to a SAT formula and checked for a satisfiability. Yeah? Because it has to be a finite program to be transformed, one technique that is used is, given a program, if there are loops, you unwind it only a finite number of times. And check for bugs in that finite unfolding of the loops. Basically, it's based on the belief that if there are bugs, they will be in a small model. It's a small model hypothesis. If there are bugs, they will be in a small model. And CBMC is one such thing which transforms C programs to a satisfiability problem, unwinds loops to a finite number of times. I'll skip this. You can write an infinite program. See, some a bounded model checker will just unbound it, unbind it for a finite number of times and analyze for that. Absolutely. So it's unsound. So bounded model checkers are unsound. I'll skip this because of time. Again, so as I have shown earlier, loops cause a lot of problem. And those same loops that we saw earlier cause a whole lot of problem. Here is one additional loop which just says while n is not 0, log assigns, does some computation which assigns some value to n, and again if it's n is not 0, unlocks. So you want to know that you never do log twice and you never do unlock twice. That's what you want to show, right? And you will never do it because you are doing an unlock only when n is not 0, and when n is not 0, you will again enter the loop. If n is 0 is the only time you will exit the loop, and if n is 0, you won't be doing an unlock, right? So it's clear that it won't happen. But a simple SAT solver or any number of unrollings with some unrollings will be able to, for any number of unrollings, you will say the property holds, but you are never sure. It may throw up in some later unrolling. Right? These two are problems we have already seen. So actual programs have loops with large unknown bounds, and therefore bounded model checkers are good to find bugs, but they are not really good to show that it's free of bugs. That's the problem with bounded model checkers. So what do people do? So given a loop like this, they do two things. One is an abstraction or an induction. So in an abstraction, in this particular case, for instance, you really don't care whether there's a while loop or not. You just assume n is assigned an arbitrary value, let this take place, and you check if n is 0, does this unlock ever happen twice. Now we have eliminated the loop, and the values that will reach here will be a superset of values that will reach here in the original program. Yeah, because I am just doing an arbitrary assignment to n and just letting any final termination would do the same thing. Right? So this is an abstraction, and in this case it works. That's good enough to prove this property. Or you use induction, wherein this loop has this property at this point, unlock is called XOR n is equal to 0. That's a property that holds at this point of the loop at any iteration. Yeah? Any iteration this property holds. You either have called unlock because you have come from here, in which case n is not 0, or n is equal to 0. You have come from here and n is 0. So it's an XOR, mutually exclusive one. And you use that to be able to prove it. So there are tools that do both, try abstractions and try to prove properties, or apply, try to discover invariants and try to prove properties. That's the kind of techniques that people use today. So here is an experiment that we have conducted using abstractions to try and prove properties. So what we have applied are abstractions, and here is the size of code. This is a number of 8,000 lines of code, 170,000 lines of code. So that's the size at which we have been able to analyze. And this says the difference between this and this says the number of properties that we were able to prove. Yeah. So 29 out of 94, we were not able to prove 29. The rest we were able to prove as being safe. Yeah. So that's just gives you a feeling for abstraction, how much it helps in being able to prove properties, prove that it is safe. So bounded model checkers are very good at finding bugs, but if you apply them using abstraction, it can help, and fairly large pieces of code, these are 170k, and this gives you the time. 170k takes around 9 hours, 9.5 hours. It takes around 10 hours. Right? but it's useful. Is the, yeah, and this is, no, this were the alarms reported by potential zero divisions reported by static analysis, and only 29 were left as reported after the bounded model checker. All the rest were proved to be false alarms. C. Programming language is C. These were zero division and array index out of bound. We have an abstraction technique which we apply on loops to make it bounded. Very different results. It's because it's similar results, very different results. So in any way you measure, it gives very different results. The nature of the code, the kind of loops they have, the kind of arithmetic operations they perform, all of that affect. And it's not very well understood as to what causes these kind of problems as far as model checking is concerned. Static analysis is fairly. Static analysis, that's an area of research, to be able to use static analysis to say, okay, here are, so that's one of the work we have done, to be able to say that this particular thing, this kind of coding, your model checker is going to give you a, is not going to work on this, to be able to predict that. That's one area of research. Yeah. I'll quickly go through a couple of applications. So Microsoft, I said, has used to hang a lot because of drivers were coded incorrectly, and therefore they applied verification technique to be able to, and said that every driver manufacturer, that is a printer, HP, whoever gives drivers, they have to get it checked using, and which all they said was, if you are going to interact with our operating system, this is the protocol you need to follow. And all they checked was whether the code that they have written follows that protocol or not. Otherwise, they say, we can't certify it. And they believe it's helped a lot. Windows 7 driver, they tested around 270 bugs they found in Windows driver, which was incorrect use of this thing. So it's used in practice. Today, it's used in by Microsoft to certify drivers. And if you install a driver, it will say whether it's certified by Microsoft or not. We have also used a static analysis tool to be able to analyze large pieces of code. This is the tool that has now become a product and being sold by TCS as a product. And here our focus was to try and increase the category of bugs that is detected by static analysis. Like I said, we analyzed and found a large category could have been detected by static analysis tool. We implemented a lot of them in this. So we have had a wide range of bugs that has been implemented in this. Now a reality check. Where are we after all this? So if you look at the numbers I've given, I'm exaggerating a bit when we say that we can verify a few million lines of code. Let's assume we can verify a few million lines of code. And we are talking of sequential code. So all the code that I had presented or whatever reports were given are single programs which are running on one processor, one machine at a time. Now if you look at a modern car, modern Mercedes or a BMW, advanced, it has a billion lines of code, which is an order of magnitude more than what we can do today. Yeah? And it's got more than 100 ECUs. That is, there are 100 different programs running which are communicating with each other, an area that's not even touched. There are people doing research on it, but very little progress has been made that can be applied in practice. So these are modern cars, and that's where the state of the, even that, when I say state of the practice, it's on the border of research and practice. It's not yet fully part of practice. And that's the reason you will continue to see more recalls. It will only increase as we go. And plus, we are getting into sophisticated algorithms, image processing, where we don't even know what is correct and what is wrong. We don't even know how to say what is correct and what is wrong. So that's the gap that exists between where verification technology is today and what's needed by the industry. Thank you. So what it means is, so incorrect access of shared variables. There are some interesting things like we found that if a bunch of variables are accessed together most of the time and they are not accessed together in one or two places, it's likely to be an error. There are whole heap of such gaps. Zero division array index, of course, is there. Oh, there is a lot of work that's been done which combines dynamic and a lot of security checking is done. They do a concolic testing kind of things, which is combines the two. But scale remains a challenge. So that's what I said. So one of the things we are trying is trying to do apply model checking to eliminate them. There is, you could have more and more sophisticated. The ASTRI, the tool that one of the static analysis tool, the approach they are taking is use more and more sophisticated abstract interpretation. So what they do, for example, is work very closely with Airbus. Airbus, for instance, claims that, I don't remember one of their models, they have proved it to be free of one bunch of categories of errors. And so they, the approach they have taken is do more and more sophisticated abstract interpretation. Huge. Yeah.
People who are to build high integrity systems, I mean, you would be the first call of, you know, people who would be asked to build high integrity systems, right? I mean, defense, aerospace. What do you do and what would you advise?
Okay.
From your perspective.
So, my personal belief, so, but one thing I'll tell you, I have presented a billion lines for a modern car. A satellite has much smaller lines of code, or a jet fighter has much fewer. A car represents one of the more sophisticated in terms of number of lines of code. But I do believe if verification technology is applied, if packaged in the right way and applied in the right way so that you show small components, build the environment models and then apply it, it should be able to scale, but we need to work on not just individual tools, but an entire ecosystem of an environment that will help develop such safe code. Incremental analysis, for example, it's hardly done. That itself will help a lot. I'm checked in something in CVS, I'm extracting, I should be able to say what new bugs I've added, instead of reanalyzing the whole thing. So a lot of things can help. So, jet fighter, it's not Airbus, mind you, jet fighter I'm talking of, which is less than, I think it's around a million or slightly less than that. Fighter aircraft is a million or less. Airbus would have more than that. Airbus would have more than that. So that's a good question. Now that comes to a debate on, given, for example, Airbus, ABS systems. Now, whether a human will be able to manage when there is a oil slick on the road and you have to brake, will the human, what are the probability that human will be able to manage it better than an automated system? So now it's not such an easy answer, because it's not that humans are free of errors. So the whole claim of Mercedes and BMW, or Tesla for that matter, which met with two crashes, will be that we are still better than humans. See, writing specification, it's not a matter of culture. Today, we do not have a feasible way of doing it. It's just too hard to write specification. As I said, or there was one present, a couple of days someone presented, they can draw graphs, but you ask them to say what the specification is, they don't know. Intuitively, they know what's right and wrong. You show them, is this right, is this wrong, they'll be able to see. But you tell them, specify what is correct, they won't be able to do it. So it's not about a culture, it's about whether the techniques are feasible, is it even feasible, is a question. I don't know what that means, but if I rephrase that question to say, do safety standards require verification? Then yes, many of them do. Auto industry has ISO 26262, which requires that you use static analysis tools. It requires that you use semi-formal techniques. The Airbus industry, DO-178B, has got these rules and this kind of techniques. And just coming back to your question, the another difference between an Airbus and a Mercedes-Benz, Airbus comes with a new model once in 15 years. An automotive company has to come up with a new model every 6 months or so. They have this additional challenge of time constraint. Pilots are trained, it runs in more protective environments, it doesn't run in arbitrary environments. There are many. Car is much harder and more sophisticated than although intuitively we feel an aircraft is much more sophisticated than.
So no more questions, then TFR community just gave you a couple of books about TFR.
Thank you. Thank you.
Did the team topic speak about just a friendly better collection? And for two still more than to go.